Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the September 25, 2016 session, focusing on 1 Timothy 6, verses 6 through 19, Desire. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Bert Montgomery.
And I'm Daniel Glaze.
Well, tonight we're looking at a text that, well, at least on the surface, may seem gentle and comforting, but with a deeper look, I wonder if it's a more challenging text than it first appears. Bert, can you help us get started with a look at the passage?
Yeah, I'll try to. It is an uncomfortable passage. And I want to start by quoting the 14th century mystic, St. Catherine of Siena, who saying, "Money changes everything." No, that's the 20th century pop star Cyndi Lauper. But it wasn't the Apostle Paul, but rather the rock star Paul Hewson, better known as Bono, who gave us this great line, "Like a preacher stealing hearts at a traveling show for the love of money, 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 money." This passage is all about money. And as Pink Floyd once said, money, so they say, is the root of all evil today. This passage contradicts that a little bit. It's the love of money is the root of all evil. Now, this passage, this text, this letter was written in a political context. It was written in the context of the Roman Empire with great disparities of wealth and power. And the only way that people could become rich, the only way that people could get possessions and have things at that time was in cooperation with the Roman government, with the Roman administration. If you were rich, you were in cahoots with the system that oppressed the vast majority of the empire, vast majority of people in the empire. So this letter is very counter-cultural. The Christian message is very counter-cultural, against riches, against wealth, against power, against greed, all of these other kind of things. Now, it is important to note that the wealthy, the rich themselves, are not evil. In fact, the Bible doesn't say that, but it is how we strive for, how we long for, how we worship having things that keeps us in bondage. If we share things, if we have a lot of things, but we share things, this seems to be the godly way. So the letter, the author of the letter to Timothy is writing in a contrast, in a very politically charged atmosphere of oppression, of great social inequality, and he's talking about desire, and he's talking about contentment, which if you study any basic Buddhism, the basic Buddhist tenets of Buddhism is that all life is suffering. Why is all life suffering? Because we all have desires for things we cannot have, things, wants, desires that are never satisfied. We want more, we want more, we want more for the love of money, for the love of material, for the love of stuff. And to be content means to let go of your desire. And I think that's at the heart of what we get to here. The first verse in our text today is, "There is great gain in godliness combined with contentment." We brought nothing into the world. We can take nothing out of the world. For the love of money is the root of all evil, but money itself is not. So what are we doing with our desires? Jesus, if I may go back to the gospel, Jesus says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God," right? Where are our desires? I think what we need to talk about today is going to be a political context, obviously, a power context, obviously. But when it gets right down to it, we're talking about life in God, eternal life here and now, or putting our faith in riches that can be taken away from us. So if you would, let's stroll back down. I may use an analogy from my hometown of New Orleans. Let's take a ride together and talk about this streetcar named Desire.
I just wish you could have worked in a reference or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of rough there at the beginning The Cyndi Lauper thing was a little rough.
I was just thinking, I'm glad no one gets rich by being in cahoots with the government anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, it's good that doesn't happen.
Bert, I really just felt like you could have replaced the time period in which you were talking about and talked about where we are today.
I firmly believe that we can make a lot of comparisons between the Roman Empire and our material life today in the United States of America, politically, economically, consumeristically, militarily. I think there's a lot to understanding the Christian faith that we can glean from if we understand the Bible and the New Testament in that context in a way that we haven't thought about before.
I mean, people just say, follow the money, right? If you want to know why things happen the way they do or what people's motivations are, follow the money.
Follow the money. And that's just as true in churches.
It is. It absolutely is.
No, it's not. I mean, seriously, why would you say that?
So much of our church life is about those who give. Those who give a lot like to hold that over people when controversial decisions get made.
I mean, so often the people who give the most in churches hijack all the power in churches. And when you're talking about at a denominational level, the churches who give the most hijack the power within the denomination. Mm-hmm. And denominations then are bound to what these big giving churches want.
Exactly.
Even if it's not reflective of what an entire group wants.
Money changes everything. Cindy Lauper's right.
That's right. And I don't want to get too politically in the weeds here. I probably shouldn't say this, but I think if, you know, whether you agree with it or not, the Citizens United Supreme Court case, the court decided that money is speech. Mm. And whether you think that's right or wrong, it's true. Money speaks, and the more money you have, the louder you get to speak.
Yep.
And that's true in our government. The way that we are set up. We're a capitalist society. But I think the church should behave differently. As I'm listening to us talk, I find myself going, oh, but I love the church. Like I'm being so incredibly critical. Yeah. And at the same time, I'm one of the biggest advocates for local church that you will ever find. I love local church. And I think that one of the reasons I become so passionate when we talk about issues like this and the way that they affect the local church is because I understand that on one hand, when it comes down to either we let the person with all the money control things or we shut our doors, that's actually a really difficult decision to make. And so my do not mistake my passion for aggression. But I do feel very passionate about those people who would hijack local churches or denominations or pastors because they can.
Well, and to be clear, I mean, obviously, we don't want to stereotype either, right? I mean, not all persons who give generously
have motives
which are suspect, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I think we have to look in the mirror, too, and realize that, you know, institutions have strengths and weaknesses.
Yes.
And at different eras, some strengths, you know, are dominant and some weaknesses are dominant.
Sure.
And, you know, so like if you're coming out of a period of chaos – the strength of the institution and in that it brings order and it brings consistency and it brings perhaps even justice and fairness because of the institution. Those are all celebrated and welcomed, but you know, it taken to an extreme, they can obviously lead to corruption or misuse. And I think that's what I hear us speaking to is that a weakness of any institution to allow itself to, you know, compromise its core because of those forces. And I think maybe what this text is drawing us, you know, to look at is, well, what Bert was referring to, you know, in his introduction, which was the effect of our consumeristic society and desire. Mm-hmm. And maybe we ought to talk some about desire a bit more. I desire to talk more about desire.
Yeah. And I think that's where we should go. But I want to say that's a good correction and a good kind of pullback, David, that and Bert said it in his introduction that being rich is there's nothing wrong with being wealthy. Like, absolutely nothing wrong with being wealthy. And so often the generosity of people who are wealthy is what has allowed institutions to do their very, very best work.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm
a product of that.
I was going to say the exact same thing. I'm a product of that.
Yes.
And I was sort of sitting here quiet. I don't disagree with anything that we shared in an effort to call the church to be greater. But I'm grateful, at least, and I probably have rose colored glasses on. But I'm grateful to be in a church where I see folks giving generously and even anonymously so often. Because they want to build up the body.
Yes.
And it is a beautiful thing. I know folks, because I have great relationships with them, who believe that God gave them mm-hmm. certain abilities which have allowed mm-hmm. them to be successful monetarily.
Right.
And they love to give as a way of saying thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded of that great Tony Campolo quote. I think he was preaching. I probably don't have the details right. He was preaching, and someone said, "Well, then I guess it's a sin for me to have $1 million." And he said, "No, no, no. It's a sin for you to keep it to yourself."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're getting at is how do we use what God has given us? Do we use it on ourselves and say, you know, well, forget about the rest. Let them pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
Yeah, and I just want, because I was pretty harsh earlier as well, I want to mention, I mean, I got through seminary through the gracious scholarships donated by people who had money, who gave to seminary to fund seminary students for education. And I think that's what the author of this text gets to, right? Their trust to those who are rich in this world. Tell them, do not be proud, do not trust in their money, which will soon be gone. Their trust should be in God, who richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. Tell them to use their money to do good. They should be rich in good works and should give generously to those in need, always being ready to share with others by whatever God has given to them. So being wealthy in and of itself is not bad. It's what you do with it. And it's, again, I think it gets back to your desire. Is your desire to hoard, to get more? Or is it to have and to share? And that seems to be the theme, I think, of the letter.
Well,
here
I think the conversation about contentment is also part of it, right? It's about, you know, where do we find our purpose and our satisfaction? Is it through having more, getting more, being more successful, whatever that means? Or is it something else? And, you know, I have to say, I have enjoyed watching some young people who allow me to be close enough to them to watch them, that, you know, I think there is something to this younger generation that I sense that they are not as, at least many of them are not as driven in the same success terms as maybe mm-hmm. some previous generations, including my own, have been. They live by, and I guess the things I notice are this desire to live more simply, mm-hmm. Because they don't want to be beholden to, whether it's mm-hmm. in more debt than their student debt already has,
yeah.
or just beholden to a lifestyle that then causes them to have to work and be in certain ways they don't want to be. They mm-hmm. want to experience life and be with their friends and travel, and that's more important than, you know, the accumulation of goods and stuff. So it's a different focus. It's a different value.
And how many of us, like if you walked into the self-help aisle right now, how many books would you find about how to simplify life, how to declutter, how to get rid of everything that doesn't bring you absolute joy in your closet or whatever the thing is now? People are monetizing simplification.
Yeah. I was going to say that section is right next to the, you know, how to get rich in 60 days. So people know exactly what they're doing.
Right. They do. They do.
Yeah.
And it's such a, we are gatherers and hoarders. And some of that is, I think some of that is primitive. Don't let go of things because you might not have them later, which is such a fearful way to live, I think. Mm. Because I think what Scripture tells us, when you read the whole story of Scripture, it is, there's always enough. And certainly, you know, in our first world, that is true. There are places in this world where sometimes there's not. But for those of us who live in the United States right now, there is. There's just generally enough.
I think you make a good point with our tendency to hoard and to collect. I'm terrible about hoarding things. I keep all kinds of stuff. And I'm not talking about my interest in vintage things that I collect. That's different. I'm just saying I just keep junk. And my wife, bless her heart, she's so patient and calm and soft-spoken, but she managed to get me into my office a couple of weekends ago. And she was like, you know, I'm going to paint your office, because she's the painter in our house. She loves to paint. She's good at it. I'm terrible at it. And she's like, but I really need to kind of clear out some of this so I can, you know, get to the walls and paint. And so we ended up, I'm like, okay, well, I'll clean up a little bit, you know, 4 hours later. And, you know, but I got to thinking, what is it that's making me, I don't need this, I don't need that, I don't need the stuff in this box. Why is this here? I haven't opened this in years. Why am I hanging on to it?
David, do you have a box of cords that you keep just in case you might need the cord?
That's my, no, you're exactly right. That is the, I know, I have it right away. I cleaned it out, but there's still, there's one bin left that has cords of all sizes and types. That's what I was going to say was, because in my head, there's this little voice going, but I might need that.
Yeah.
You know, just in case. Okay. And sure enough.
Oh, yeah.
Sure enough, a friend asked me for an old, what do they call, compact flash card that the cameras used to use. I just threw my last one out in that cleaning out experience. So I couldn't give it
justified,
to him.
Right?
See? So I should have hung on to it. But no, I joke about it. But I mean, really, how much of that that psychological thinking is what goes on with us in a bigger picture sense, that we don't think there's enough. We don't think that there's a way to make it. We might need that and regret it later.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the other point I want to come back to, and I forget, Bert, what you said that made me think about it, but was that, you know, we tend to think of often of this accumulation of stuff or the consumerism in our society as a me thing, right? How much do I need? What am I going to work toward? What do I need to get? But in fact, all these things are relational, right? I mean, at least for a person of faith, what we have inevitably affects what someone else doesn't have in a world where there are, you know, limits to how much there is. And so, which, you know, is uncomfortable to think about, right?
It is.
Mm-hmm. And so I'll be really self-revelatory here for a moment. So I own a business. Okay. I am a business owner and I decide what people make and I decide what I make. And if I make more, at least for my small business, which is in no way a giant business, but if I make more, someone's making less.
Yeah.
If someone else makes more, I'm making less. And there's just no way around it. You know, and maybe there are companies where there's just tons of cash laying around, but there is owning a business has made me realize the relational part. Now, I know all my people. There's only four of us, you know, but doggone it, that matters, right? And I wonder if we somehow in our society, especially as big as things have gotten, that we forget the faces and the names of the people that our choices affect.
Can we use a real life news story right now that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the prices of prescription drugs. And nowhere has this been more relevant than EpiPen now. And, you know, and people saying, well, people can't afford drugs, the drugs that they're prescribed and all this kind of stuff. Well, it's just the price of drugs. Well, what we're learning is it's not just simply the price of drugs. It's the price that people have put on the drugs to give themselves an incredibly lavish lifestyle.
Yeah.
And with this EpiPen, you know, the cost to produce it and the cost to sell it, and even the cost to sell it and get a little bit of a profit for your company, for yourself, is not that much. But then just to say, I want to, you know, exponentially increase it so I can exponentially get greater profits from those who can afford to buy it at that rate. But then that denies it to so many people who desperately need this at a cheap price. And it's not just EpiPen. I mean, it's the whole pharmaceutical companies, that sociologists and business economists are talking about, that this great desire to hoard, to grab all the money we can get from somebody, denies it to so many other people. And it really wouldn't be that hard, if we're going to talk about people of faith, if I'm a person of faith in one of those companies, to say, I don't need enormous, unbelievably amount of profit. I can get by with and still be very, 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 very comfortable on a little bit less profit and make it more affordable to everybody, and pay my employees a good amount.
I'm sorry. I think I interrupted you, Bert.
No, that's – I mean, it's just – that's what I'm thinking. It's troublesome to me.
Yeah. And what strikes me is – and this goes back to what you were saying, David. I mean, it's – this is not a faceless affliction that we have.
No.
You know, David, you talked about I know these four folks. And this is – I mean, this issue in particular about the EpiPens and – I think it's called Mylan is the big drug company. I mean, I not to be morbid, but some children are going to do without, and some children are going to die.
Yes,
because yes. And that's not me being dramatic. That's me.
That's
hopefully.
That's
I mean,
fact.
I hate that I'm telling the truth there,
but it's true. That is what will happen
because a drug that cost $100 $6 ago is now like $600 or $700.
Yeah.
And for no other reason than we can just hike the price up and get more profit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I mean it's not a faceless thing. This is there are real consequences to our behavior here. It's not a well, you know, I'm getting more for myself and I'm not hurting anybody in the process. Sometimes we are. Mm-hmm. And what's difficult, and I think what you were doing, David, is to say, you know, as much as I'd like to say, oh, but it's them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's me.
You know, and if you want to get really biblical, I mean, the biblical prophets, especially Micah, Isaiah, Micah and Amos, would go to town on this because, as you said, children are going to die. Adults are going to die. And this is maybe the message of the church for leaders of big companies, for leaders, but also for ourselves.
Yes.
Gets into this last part. If you're rich, which I quoted earlier, do not be haughty. Don't be proud. Don't hoard your riches in this comfort now, because all this is going to fade away. Do good, be generous, and share. Maybe we need to be proclaiming that in our churches, because we've got corporate leaders in our churches. We've got bankers in our churches. We've business leaders in our churches. We've got us in our churches with what we have, you know, that anytime we take a little more than we need, it's going to hurt somebody else in very real terms.
Which gets back to the contentment, right? If we find that place where our lives and purpose are truly centered, it's enough.
And it's enough.
Enough is a much lower level than the commercials on TV tell us enough is.
So this makes me think about why we hoard, why we hang on to things. And I don't know if this has always been true, but I think that today, so much of having is about our status. It's about how we are perceived. I mean, if you think about the person who hijacks the power in a local church, it's about status. It's about how important they are within that community. And so since we've told all of these negative stories, did you hear the story about J.K. Rowling?
No, I didn't.
So she's the first person ever to fall off the Forbes billionaire list because she gave so much to charity. Now, we yes. could laugh this off and say, oh, but she's still a hundred millionaire.
Yeah.
And yes, she is. She's rolling in the cash. She is probably making more money than she is able to spend mm-hmm. because of her wild success. But here's what is interesting to me. Being on that Forbes list is really about status. I mean, $999 million doesn't get you on the list, right? You've got to be a billionaire. And she was not beholden to that status. She could have given billions and remained on the list. She could have given all kinds of amounts of money and still stayed on the list for the sake of status. But I think that when we recognize that our status, like here in this world, the way other people perceive us needs to be less important, that might be one step in the right direction. Or maybe it's that we find ourselves wanting to be seen as a status of someone who gives rather than someone who holds on to and clings to things.
Well, we are all richer than we wish to admit, and we have more to give than we realize. But also, I guess I wish for all of us to find the joy in contentment that God does provide and has provided. And for those of us who have much, that we have this wonderful gift and opportunity to care for those who do not. May we each find that joy, the same joy that God seems to show in God's own character, to give until giving hurts. Thanks for this conversation, and I look forward to next time.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thanks. Good night. Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.